So this morning, it's Tuesday morning at Akiva, November 29th. We're learning Parshat Shavua. The Parsha is Parshat V'yetzei. And we're going to do something different this morning, something that I think I mentioned 2 or 3 months ago we'll eventually do, which is to study the Parsha from the perspective, not of the pshat, and that's a word I'll explain, but from the perspective, from a Hasidic perspective. The perspective of a book called V'mei HaShiloach, which I'll talk about right now. So to make a long, 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 long story pretty short, it's been always traditional, especially since the Middle Ages, to talk about 4 different levels of Torah interpretation, which we call the pshat, and the drash, and the remez, and the sod. I'm not even going to try and translate them. I'm not going to even talk about them. What I will do is divide those 4 into 2 groups. The pshat, as opposed to everything else. The pshat, as opposed to the drash, the remez, and the sod. And this distinction is basically as follows. The pshat is the simple meaning of the text. What the text would have meant when originally promulgated, when originally spoken, in its an original historical, sociological context, what would people who heard it have understood? That's the pshat. You might want to call it authorial intent, what the author meant. And there are different nuances of explanation, how exactly we define pshat. Some people say, what I think it says is pshat, what you think it says is not pshat. It's the straightforward, direct meaning of the text, the pshat. And the other 3 levels of meaning, drash, remez, sod, without distinguishing between them, they're all further, deeper, more expanded, more tenuous, you could say, levels of interpretation, not what it means in context, not what the author would have meant when it was spoken, not what you would have understood in the first generation, but something else, something deeper. You can say the following, that anyone who interprets a text, at least Jewishly, begins with questions. I see a verse and I ask, what does that word mean? I see a verse and I say, here's a present tense connected to a future tense. How could that be? Or this verse says X, whereas another verse, a few chapters or a different book of the Torah says Y. How do I reconcile between these 2 things that seem to be contradictory? Or why is this word written twice in one verse? Why is it a superfluous idea? Torah interpretation begins with questions. But if we're looking for the pshat interpretation, then I'm looking for an answer to the question that fits into the context, that answers the question in the simplest possible, straightforward fashion. Whereas if I'm looking for one of those other levels of interpretation, drash, remez, sod, I'm not looking for the most straightforward, most simplest answer in context. I'm looking for a meaningful answer. If I'm interpreting a level of midrash, of drash, I wouldn't give an answer, that's the way they spoke 3,000 years ago. That's a grammatical construct. That is a form of speech. No, I would find meaning, I would look for meaning in every single repetition, every single letter, every single word. We're looking for the meaningful answer and not necessarily a straightforward answer when we're dealing on a level that is beyond pshat, the level of drash or remez or sod. So almost always in this class, we try and look for the pshat. We could have different interpretations of what the pshat is. There are many interpretations, but we're looking for the pshat, and sometimes the pshat is not meaningful. It's just, that's just the way it is. But when we move to the other levels of interpretation, we're looking for a meaningful answer. And on those further levels of interpretation, drash, remez, and sod, into those categories falls the Hasidic interpretation. The Hasidic movement were beginning about the middle of the 1700s, the 18th century in Eastern Europe. There are lots of different Hasidic teachers and courtyards and movements and books and rebbes. This particular book contains the writings of Rabbi Mordechai Liner. We're in a city called Izbich in Poland in the 1840s, 50s, 60s, and even 70s. Izbich. He was, Rav Mordechai Liner, was both a friend and a student of the Rebbe Mikotsky. You've probably heard of the Kotzke Rebbe. Perhaps you haven't, perhaps you have. And in turn, the Meir Shiloach was the teacher of someone that you might have heard of, the Rabbi Tzadok mi Lublin. Rabbi Tzadok from the city of Lublin. And just to get your bearings historically, Rabbi Tzadok, the student of the Meir Shiloach, died in the year 1900 exactly. Exactly 111 years ago. So the Meir Shiloach, Rav Mordechai Lina of Izbich, Izbich HaChasidut, as it says here, Izbiche, it looks like the material here was spoken around the Shabbat table at Suda Shlishit, the third meal of Shabbat, and near the end of Shabbat in the late afternoon when the sun is about to go down and we're trying to capture the last essence of Shabbat. We're singing together, we're talking together, we're learning together. The Chasidim is sitting on the table, probably not more than a few dozen. And Rav Mordechai Lina speaks his mind on the Parsha. He's not looking for the pshat, he's looking to say something meaningful of his religious philosophy, something that's important for his students to hear, and he connects it to the parsha in a way that's, again, not directly related to the pshat.
Do you traditionally speak of the parsha for the coming or for the past?
That's a good question.
Because you just finished Mincha, which is the coming.
Right. I think it's the present of that Shabbat.
Which means?
Of that Shabbat,
the one you read.
What we've read
in the
read
morning?
For the past 7 days, yeah.
Okay.
For the past 7 days. The parsha that's about to pass. So, I'll tell a little anecdote, a story about the Meir Shiloach, so we don't have too much time for introductions, in order to get into it. Two stories. One is, he didn't speak. When he spoke around the Shabbat table, he didn't speak from notes. Nothing was written down. And of course, when he was speaking, no one took notes. It was Shabbat. But his grandson recorded the words we have here. It was spoken in Yiddish, and this is written in Hebrew. And it was spoken, it was written a while after it was heard. So it's approximate. We don't know exactly what was said. But this is the record we have of what Rav Mordechai Lina spoke around the Shabbat table to his Hasidim.
You mean he recorded it after the Shabbat?
Not he, his grandson.
The grandson.
He didn't record at all.
The grandson recorded
yeah.
it.
After and I don't know exactly when he recorded it, if it was that night or a few years later. I don't know.
He wrote it down.
He wrote it down, which is, of course, not a direct recording.
Yeah, that's why I asked.
Something else important
recorded.
To say is the following. I bought this book when it wasn't available on the in the market. A friend of mine bought it from the grandson of the Meir Shiloach. And I was told the following story by my friend, who's now the head librarian of the Gershom Shalom collection of the National Jewish Library on Givat Ram in Jerusalem. But that's a whole different story.
Wow.
And the story goes that the grandson of the grandson said that for many decades, they used to sell only a few dozen of these books a year. But for the past 20 or 25 years, they've been selling hundreds, perhaps even thousands, every year. What made the difference? There's one man who's responsible for the resurgence of the study of this book in the past 20 years. And that man's name is Rav Shlomo Karbach.
Yeah. Oh,
Rav Shlomo, you could say, discovered this book in the dustbins of history. It wasn't well known before his time. Perhaps there were a few Hasidim setting it around the world. Perhaps grandchildren and great-grandchildren of the author. Perhaps Hasidim. It's not a Hasidic courtyard that has hundreds or thousands of members. But Rav Shlomo Karbach found it, and it resonated with him. And he began to study it and teach it. And today his students and his students teach it. Students have revived the study of the Meir Shiloach. There's something here that deeply resonates with many, many modern and postmodern people, as we're about to see.
And when did he live?
The Meir Shiloach, thank you, I forgot to say. Well, I did know, I did say, you missed it.
Okay.
We're talking about 1840s to 1870s when these words were spoken. We're in Izbich. You don't know where Izbich is? Neither do I.
Where?
It's in Poland. Izbich.
1840s.
1840, 50, 60, perhaps even 70. And again, the student of the Meir Shiloach, Rav Tzadok mi Lublin, of Lublin, died in 1900. so you can get your bearings there. Yeah, this is the last one I have. So, Tony.
Precious.
We're going to read very quickly the first few words of the Parsha, and then go on to the words of the Mei HaShiloach. So I'm reading Parshat Vayetze, which is chapter 28 of the book of Genesis. Chapter 28, verse 10. And that we're reading that is written on the source sheets that I gave out. So here we are, Parshat Vayetze. Yaakov left Beersheba. Remember, he's fleeing from his brother, from whom he stole the blessing, and set out for Haran, to stay with his mother's family for a few days or months or years. It turns out to be decades. He came upon a certain place and stopped there for the night, for the sun had set. Remember that in the past... Good morning.
Good morning.
Remember that in the past, just 2 weeks ago, we said this is the source for Tfilat Aravit, the evening prayers. Taking one of the stones of that place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place. He had a dream, a stairway was set on the ground, and its top reached to the sky. An angel of God were going up and down on it. And the Lord was standing beside him, and he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac. The ground on which you are lying, I will assign to you and to your offspring. Your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you and your descendants. That's the blessing of Abraham that's given to Abraham, to Yitzhak, and now to Yaakov. Remember, I am with you. I will protect you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. That's what we're going to read. Now the Mei HaShiloach.
So you have the translation?
I'll say a word about that. This is Hebrew, right? That's the way it was written. We don't know the original Yiddish. That was not recorded. And there's an English translation available, which is on the sheets that I photocopied. It's a terrible translation. It's terrible. It's not that I don't agree with it. It's that the person who did it really didn't know the Mei HaShiloach that well. It's a young student who became enamored by the words of the Mei HaShiloach and wanted to do his Rebbe, Rav Shlomo Karba, a favor by translating to English, but it's not a good job. So it's
the English. The Hebrew is also a translation.
Yeah, okay.
But it's the only English translation we have.
Yeah. So I've made some corrections in it.
The Hebrew is a translation
from the Yiddish. Yeah.
So let's go on. If we're looking on the back of the sheet, we're beginning about the sixth line in English, where I put a little horizontal, vertical divider there. And in the Hebrew, it's also about six lines down where I put a little paragraph sign. So the opening words are "Vehine anochi imach," behold, I am with you, which is from the words of God, what we just read, in Jacob's vision of the angels going down and up. "Vehine anochi imach," "Velo ne'mar ani," "Ki ot hachaf mora al makor ha'chayim v'lidah." Translation, behold, I am with you. And it doesn't say ani, because the letter haf teaches on the unlimited source of life. And we're going to stop there for a moment. So
where
I have to put this
square page
on the board. Not here.
No, in the
here.
In the Hebrew.
Right? It's right over here. Moved again right over here. And behold, I am with you. Everyone see the place? So I'm going to put on the board something that I just read.
Yeah, now I see. I looked at a different page.
So
I couldn't.
It distinguishes between two ways of writing the word I and saying the word I. You can have the word ani, and you can have the word anochi. And the difference between them is one letter.
Kaf.
They both mean the same thing. Ani is more common. Anochi is less common.
Strange.
But we don't know of any difference in meaning. What's called morphology. There's no difference in meaning. They're written differently. And if we're talking on the level of shat,
the simple meaning of the verse. We'd say there's no meaning, there's no difference, it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. But for the Hasidic author, the teacher, more than Hailina, of course it matters. Every word and every letter matters. So the question is, why, when God says to Yaakov, I'm with you, why does God speak with an extra letter, with the Chaf? And his answer is going to be, it's not written right here, we'll get to it, his answer is going to be that that letter has independent meaning. Because someone who knows the Hebrew language knows that the letter Chaf is also a word. Just like in English we have small words like the and a, right? The letter of one, a word of one letter. The Chaf in Hebrew is a word of one letter, it means something. When Chaf is appended as a prefix to a word, Chaf means approximately. Almost, kind of, about, more or less. And the Meshulam is reading this word as if it says, not I am with you, but approximately I am with you. Almost, a little bit, kind of, more or less. So now, I'm going to print that. And we'll see that the way to understand what he's saying is not written here, it's written in a different piece he wrote, a different piece he said. So we're going to move now to his writings on the Ten Commandments, which is a longer piece that I photoshopped. And there he's going to explain what I just wrote on the board and how he goes from this matter of the Chaf, the letter Chaf, to this matter of Makor Hayim Lidai, the unlimited source of life. How is a letter that means approximately, how is that the unlimited source of life? So he doesn't explain here, but he does explain on the Ten Commandments. So we're going to the Ten Commandments, which is Parshat Yitro. And the first commandment, as we know, is I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. It's chapter 20 of the book of Exodus. And it just so happens, and of course it's no coincidence, according to this author, that when God says, I am the Lord your God, he does not say, Ani, but he says, Anochi, with the Chaf there. So the same question exists. The same question on the words that God spoke to Jacob, Hine Anochi Imach, behold, I am with you. Same question, why Anochi, why the Chaf? The same question exists on the Ten Commandments. Why does it say, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I, Lord your God, I as Anochi with the Chaf. And he says, V'lo ne'mar ani, and it doesn't say ani, ki ilu haya ketuv ani, had it been written ani, haya mashma, it would imply, shegila az HaKadosh Baruch Hu le'Yisrael et kol aro b'shlemut, v'lo yuchlu achar kach lamik b'dvarav. Translation, it doesn't say I, because had it been written I, it would imply that at that point, the Holy One, blessed be He, revealed to Yisrael all of His light completely, and it wouldn't have left any possibility of further inquiry. The English translation is close to that. Again, it's a little bit difficult, but we understand that he's saying the following. Had God revealed himself absolutely and completely at Har Sinai, everything would be known, everything would be clear, there would be no room left afterwards to think, to search, to yearn, to desire, to try and find it all out, because I'd have it already. And therefore God has to reveal himself only partially, only incompletely, only approximately with the letter Chaf, in order that afterwards there be some further work to do. And I'm going to go out the other door this time. The difference between Anochi and Ani is the following. Ani. That's Ani. God reveals himself completely. Not God, but I'm just taking his place for a moment. But when God reveals himself with the word Anochi, it's like this. It's hide and seek. God wants to give a taste. He wants to create a framework for yearning and for desiring and for study, but he doesn't want to give it all away.
it has to be a journey, and it has to be a little bit, or even a lot, challenging. That's what he's saying. Let's read on. Ki kvar gila hakol. Just had God revealed himself completely, everything would be known. Achachaf mora sheno b'shlemut. But the chaf indicates that it's not complete. The revelation is not complete. V'rak demut u'dimayonhu. And it's only a shadow. L'ha'or shigileh kodesh baruch hu latid. It's only a shadow of the light that God will reveal in the future. V'chol ma shi'asig ha'adam yoter amkut b'divrei Torah, yiresh ad akshav haya b'choshech. And all that man will acquire, will reveal greater depth in the words of Torah, he will see that until now he was in darkness. I always have to be ready and open to the possibility that what I know today will turn out tomorrow to have been darkness.
A shadow.
Say it again?
A shadow.
A shadow. And this is indicated by day and night. In other words, as if to say that the structure of the universe, this day and night, is indicative of a deeper epistemological truth. Which is to say, as he goes on, Hayom haynu shashem mitbarach poteach sharei chokhma ladam. Day is a metaphor for God revealing or opening the gates of wisdom for man. V'alayla haynu shelo yidme adam sheisiga kol b'shleimut. And laila, nighttime, is that man will never think that he has discovered everything completely. Because everything that he has discovered is like night compared to the day that will follow. So all my light, I know, is really only darkness compared to what I will learn tomorrow. And it's an ideal. It's an ideal that I know already when I have light that it's really only darkness. So there's a great emphasis here on humility, that all the knowledge I have, all the Torah I have, all the wisdom I have is conditional. It's conditional on the clock not ticking. But the minute the hand of the clock goes to the next second, there's the possibility of discovery, and there's the hope of discovery, that what I had a few seconds ago was a shadow of the real thing. Now, it's all I had. So it's crucial. There's no sense here that I should not latch on to the truth I have. No sense that I shouldn't believe it. No sense that I shouldn't live by it. I should live. I have to live by it. But I also have to know that tomorrow might bring future vistas, and tomorrow should bring future vistas.
So is God ever referred to himself as Ani in the Torah?
I'm sure that he does. You cannot apply this to other places. This is not pshat. Mm-hmm. Okay. It applies where the author says to apply it.
Here he says it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a moment of revelation. That's the thing.
Not only a moment of revelation, the greatest yeah. moment of revelation, the Me'ah Shiloach has the gall and the audacity to tell you it wasn't really. It was, but it wasn't. A little bit, right? It was the opening we need to have us set forth on our journeys. And he's really telling us that it's all about a journey of discovery. If God wanted to give it all, he could. But that would kill the spirituality.
Could it also kill because it would be all the power and all the might? And so we have to fear all of God's power and all of his might? So if it's not absolute, if it's not all the power, then as people, as humans, we realize that God is actually protecting us from all of his might with this chaf.
That's a related idea. It's not the same way. It's a related idea.
It's a more traditional.
That God is, let's say, God here is practicing what we call tzimtzum. He's practicing self-restriction, self-control, and he's not revealing all his power, his might. But for us, he's not revealing all his truth.
So it's the same as you can't see God's face. I mean, it's the same.
It's very much related.
So how is, and this is very much.
But here, you can't see God's face becomes an ideal. It's not a tragedy that we can't see God's face. It's right. Thank God we can't see His face, because having seen His face would have put an end to human creativity.
And to the quest.
The quest. At the end of the Torah, it says that. Wait a second. It says that Moses died at the end of 120. And the Me'e Shiloh says he died when he reached perfection. The implication seems to be that perfection is a source of death. Because if you're complete, so what's the point of living anymore? Right? To be alive is to be alive. What does alive mean? It means to be dynamic and changing. In order to change, there has to be a good that you have not yet accomplished, you have yet acquired. So it's all about the journey.
You know, may I add something? I had the privilege to study with Shai Pnueli, Hebrew literature, and he was pointing in lots of literary texts that we have a repeating motif in Hebrew literature, this tiring journey where there's no chair, there's no couch, there's no place to sit. And he was connecting it to the fact that we as Jews don't allow in a way the Mashiach to come, because if the Mashiach comes, that's the end. There's no more quest.
Very good, very good.
With things like this where we're going beyond the Peshat, or maybe in Hasidic thought, how much of this is he sees the Chaf and he goes, oh, there's deeper meaning there, and how much is it that he's, through all of his understanding, has put together a meaning and then found a way to insert it into the text?
Right. That is the million-dollar question in all of the study of deeper levels of meaning.
Right.
My personal understanding is that what we're studying really has nothing to do with the Chaf. Mm-hmm. It has everything to do with the religious philosophy and experience of Rav Mordechai Liner. But that doesn't mean it's unconnected to the text, because his whole understanding of religious experience comes from the text. Not from this particular text, but from the text as a world.
Sure.
And it's then a vehicle for that teaching.
And then he has that insight that's come from the amalgam of his interaction with the text as a whole, and then he hangs that insight, which belongs to the text, on a particular section of the text. Yeah. That's my...
Because the Chaf only means approximately when it's at the beginning of the word, right?
Right. Right.
Okay.
Right. Tony, you wanted to say something earlier?
I forgot my question. You gave me too long, so whatever.
That's my methodology in teaching. If I say just another 5 minutes, hopefully the person will forget it. Let me tell you a fascinating Talmudic passage in the Talmud of the Land of Israel, which I paraphrased on the very first page in my summary there of what we've been saying. So in Tractate Sanhedrin, the Talmud says the following, the Talmud of the Land of Israel, that when Moses went up on high to receive the Torah, and he heard God speaking, he was a bit confused by all the plethora of things he heard, and he said to God, "Heyach hi ha-halacha," which literally means, "What's the halacha?" And in the more expansive, it means, "God, I heard all these things, so now tell me the final decision. What do I have to do?" You said, you talked about Shabbat in the book of Exodus, you talked about it in the book of Deuteronomy, so what do I actually do? And all these laws and all these ideas, okay, what's the final line? What's the halakha? And God's answer was, "Ahare rabim latot," which means decide for yourselves. Decide for yourselves. Literally, follow the majority. Let's make a Beit Din, make a court, and study well, and make a decision. In other words, God is not willing to tell the Jewish people what to do. You have to figure it out for yourselves. Now, what the process is, I'm not saying. You might think it's an individual, you might think it's the collective, you might think the collective's decision is binding. Not a whole different can of kosher worms. But the idea is that God doesn't tell you what to do completely and absolutely. He gives you a framework. Again, who the you is, collective Jewish people, individual, that's a different question. And then that particular Talmudic passage ends and says, "Ilu nitna haTorah hatucha lo haita leregel amida." Had the Torah been given cut and dry, there wouldn't be a leg to stand on. Which to me seems to mean that had the Torah been clear, had the answers been all there, had there not been a chaf before the divine name, as it were, then there wouldn't be a leg to stand on. There'd be no legs to move on. There'd be no movement. There'd be no dynamism. There'd be no life. There'd be no meaning to life. The meaning to life is in the lack, or the relative lack of light. It's the partial darkness that forces us and allows us to go forward in a spiritual existential quest. That, at least for Rav Mordechai Liner, is what it's all about. Let me tell you another thought from somewhere. The Ramban, Nachmanides, in the 13th century, commentary to the Torah. In his introduction to the commentary to the Torah, he brings a very ancient Kabbalistic insight that says the following, that the real Torah, the pristine Torah, the absolute Torah, the divine Torah that's hidden in heaven someplace, is a string of divine names. It doesn't tell stories, and there's no mitzvot, it's just a string of divine names. It's all perfectly divine. It's shining with light that you cannot gaze upon. One name after another. God has hundreds of different names. Those same letters of the original pristine Torah, God divided differently into words. The same letters, divided differently into words, to tell a story. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth, to tell a story of took us out of Egypt, tell the mitzvah of you should keep Shabbat. The same letters, the same Torah, is handed to the Jewish people in a different form. Now, what this Kabbalistic metaphor means is that the Torah we have, on the one hand, is divine, is true, is perfect, but it's a shadow of the divine Torah. It's not the real absolute.
Yeah. It's not perfect and it's not dead.
It's not. It's perfect. It's the most perfect it could be for us. But the definition of perfection for us is almost lack of perfection. That's what perfection is. Because perfection is not perfect. Perfection is dead.
Well, perfection is not real.
Right. Perfection doesn't allow us to perfect ourselves. That's the way to say it, right? Perfection doesn't allow ourselves to perfect ourselves. In order to perfect ourselves, you need a lack of perfection. Therefore, God couldn't give human beings the pristine, real, absolute divine Torah. He has to give us a Torah that's best for us. And that's the idea, I think the same idea that the Meir Shiloach is talking about here, about the process.
Well, now I'll not be said when I'm not perfect.
And let me just say one more thing, a few more things that we have to understand really to absorb this. This is not about... No, let me say something else first. I often contrast what we have here, contrast it with the words of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, one of the greatest Jewish philosophers and poets of the Middle Ages. Rabbi Halevi wrote a book called Sefer HaKuzari, which is subtitled The Answers in the Defense of a Despised Faith. Answers in Defense of a Despised Faith. And he's trying to shore up Jewish confidence and Jewish belief and Jewish observance in the Middle Ages when the Jewish people are under attack spiritually from the Christian side and from the Muslim side. They all want to convert us, and he is trying to strengthen the faith of the Jewish people. And in more than one place in Sefer HaKuzari, in the book of the Kuzari, Rabbi Halevi writes that Hasafek Hara, doubt, is the enemy of religion. Doubt is the enemy of religion, and the purpose of this book that he's writing is to shore up our certainty and absolute faith in God, Torah, and the Jewish people.
It's kind of opposite.
That's the opposite of what we're saying right now. If according to Rabbi Delevi, doubt is the enemy of spirituality, well, according to the Meir Shiloh, doubt is the engine of spirituality. The engine of spirituality. It's the fuel. There can be no spirituality without doubt. If everything is clear and certain, if I know that I have truth in my back pocket, there's nothing more to learn, nothing more to progress, nothing can change in my spiritual understanding, then I'm dead, says the Meir Shiloh. Now, of course, I very conveniently didn't define what I mean by doubt, what type of doubt.
Right.
Right? Because obviously, if I don't believe in anything, I can be in no spiritual journey. I have to have a certain understanding of a framework. I have to have a certain, at least contingent, faith. But it can't be on all levels completely sealed and tied up.
Was he talking about the revelation of Sinai then? Because he spends so much time talking about that.
Right, again, I conveniently did not define what I'm saying.
Oh.
Right. But obviously, there are going to have to be some foundations of faith for the search to take place.
There has to be room for doubt, maybe.
There has to be room somewhere for doubt.
For doubt.
Yes.
Self-doubt?
Doubt doesn't need to be the foundation, but there has to be room to question and doubt.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Or at least there should be a fluttering of no doubt.
Yeah. Now, we can understand, of course, why Rebbe Yehuda Levi, 1,000 years ago, did not agree with this. Especially when you're trying to strengthen and buttress faith and community, and you're trying to maintain a bulwark against the attacks from the outside world, you don't want to teach your children that you should doubt. You want to teach your children that everything is clear and certain and absolute.
In the era of the Enlightenment, though, you would want.
So then comes the question that Adam just brought up. If we're now fast-forwarding from the year 1040 to 1060 to 1140, Rabbi Levi's lifetime, to the Enlightenment period, we're now in the 1840s, 50s, 60s. So under those circumstances, the beginning of the Enlightenment, how do you buttress faith?
Yeah.
Well, the consensus of Jewish tradition since the time of Rabbi Chailina has been, you don't buttress faith by learning the Meir Shiloh. You don't. Right? This has not been a mainstream text, and I think for obvious reasons. When Judaism sees itself as under attack by secularism on so many different levels, and it's a mentality of circle the wagons and let's maintain what we can and strengthen ourselves from within, this is not what you teach. But for the few, for the enlightened, for the elite, if you will, Rav Mordechai Lina felt that this is really the inner fuel and the power of the Jewish people. And when Rav Shlomo Carbach in 1955, 58, 60s started teaching this and learning this, he felt that this was a philosophy that would resonate with the young people that he was coming in contact with. And I think it's all the more so true today. It resonates with me. Again, like Jane said, there has to be, Adam, there has to be a foundation of faith, of living within the tradition of the Jewish people. But not with a feeling that I have the truth in my back pocket. There has to be an openness to new ideas, an openness to development, the humility of the journey, that I'm always moving and learning. And there are two words at the end of the line that I was reading that I didn't read. Those two words are v'chein le'olam, so forever. The journey never ends. It shouldn't ever end. It's always a process. Let me just see if I said everything that I wanted to say there. We talked about the... So let's just mention something we talked about 2 or 3 weeks ago. We talked about the contrast of Abraham and Noach.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So think of Noach, the man who does what he's told all the time with no creativity, no search, if you will, as opposed to Abraham, who's going before God and leading the way and within the framework, still creatively thinking and arguing. So obviously the Meir Shiloh is going in the direction of Abraham, of movement, of expansiveness, of search, of a certain degree of independence, not being the child who follows God by taking his hand, but being the adult child whose father is proud of him because that child has taken what he's learned and gone forward with it. Gone further with it. Yeah.
Is this more of a modern Orthodox text, or would you say that it's also getting more popular amongst like the ultra-Orthodox too?
It's certainly true that through Rav Shlomo Carbach, this text has become very popular and very foundational in new age Orthodox re-spiritualization movements. Mm-hmm. Again, a la Rav Shlomo Carbach.
Right.
In the Haredi world, I don't think the Me'ash Shiloach, in the ultra-Orthodox world, I don't think it's learned as much, but I might be wrong. But I certainly know the following from personal experience here in Dallas. If it is learned, for them it doesn't say what it says to me.
Right? Oh, how neat.
And I cannot explain how that's so, but I learned it with people here in Dallas who claim that it means everything but what I see that it means. And it's a conversation of the deaf. I don't hear what they're saying to me when they read the words, and they don't hear what I say when I read the words.
This is what they said that when the Torah was revealed, everybody heard it according to his level.
Yes, right. There's a beautiful midrash like that.
So when we have teenagers who question everything, this is a good thing. Yeah.
It's a good thing.
This is a good thing.
But does that mean it's a good thing to teach at Yavne? That will lead to Yavne to decide.
No, I would say maybe that means you're more like no one than you think. If you can't see what in those words, what they see.
You're right, in the sense that I have a certain blindness. I'm not saying that I'm any more or less blind than my interlocutors, that's how you say the word.
Well, there's a certain Rorschach to it all.
Yes.
You bring to it what you experience and what.
But that's
who
every
you
text.
Are. You to, exactly, every text.
Right.
Every text
especially this text, because there's so many levels.
And in your life, when you read the same text a few times, you've seen it different things.
Hopefully.
But it seems like with Hasidic texts, though, in general, there's more of a push towards faith than necessarily intellectualism.
It depends which Hasidic texts.
Okay.
But certainly in the Me'ash Shiloach and his son, the Beis Yaakov, and also in the Sfat Emet, and in Rabbi Tzadok HaKohen Milublin, the student of Me'ash Shiloach, there's the same type of, not saying the same thing, but the same type of invitation to free inquiry. Mm-hmm.
The Magid from Lublin was a student?
Rabbi Tzadok HaKohen Milublin.
Ah,
someone
okay.
else. Yeah.
So what would a more traditional interpretation of the extra letter in the word ani, what kind of drash would be formulated around that?
Okay, so you cannot say, the Me'ash Shiloach has a meaning for the Chaf, so now I know what the Chaf
that's
means.
Yeah.
What do you think it means? You can't say that. The Chaf,
no,
there's almost no connection between the Chaf and what he says. Right?
Right. But
I don't understand.
My question is, clearly there are other learned men who have struggled with why there's an extra letter in the name of the
so I don't know the answer to the question.
I don't know
the answer to the question. It might be that there's no need even to ask the question. It's just so common.
That's
sometimes
right.
Anis, sometimes Anochi, I didn't even notice. Could be.
I just wanted to add that Hasidism doesn't mean a fanatic belief. There's a great deal of rebellion in the mm-hmm. foundation of Hasidism.
That's true.
Right.
That's true. So let's go on a little bit. He now says something in the same text we're reading that is just as powerful, if not more so. In the Hebrew, I'm reading where there's a dalet, a footnote in the text. And in the English, let me just show you where we are. It's a new paragraph. This is why the verse that follows.
Is that on the Amud page?
The last page.
And this is written.
Vizeshni smach mar lo taselecha pesach. So he says, look, and that's why is juxtaposed to this first commandment of the Ten Commandments, the second commandment that says, lo taselecha pesel, don't make for yourself an idol. Now that word pesel, idol, means a carved image. Mm-hmm. That's going to be important. V'ita b'zohar kadosh, and it's written in the Holy Zohar, mishum diktib solecha, ahakap ne'amar lo taselecha pesel. I'm sorry. Al kein ne'amar lo taselecha pesel lo tavid lecha oraita uchra, which literally means the following: why is it written "Don't make for yourself a pesel"? Because it's written psolecha, which means later on in the Book of Exodus, when Moses is about to get the second tablets, God calls him up to the mountain and says, "Carve for yourself two tablets." So that word carve for yourself, the verb carve, is the same root as a noun that means a carved image. A pesel is a carved image. Psol means carve for yourself an image. So look at the contradiction. You're not allowed to have a carved image, but God tells Moses to carve an image. Now obviously on the level of pshat, there's no contradiction. This is an idol and this is the tablets. No, but the Mishnah says, wait a second, it's the same word. So what's the connection here between the tablets, which are carved, and an idol? And you perhaps can get an inkling of what he's about to say. That there's only a hair's breadth between the tablets and idolatry. They wrote the same word. Now, what the Zohar says...
Pretty.
The Zohar says, don't make for yourself a different Torah. But what the Meshiloach does with this is the following sentence. Look at this sentence. In the Hebrew, it begins after the period, Vanyan Bezeh, and the explanation of this is, Kimilat Pesel, because the word Pesel, Hu Devar Michutak B'midah, it's something that's cut to size, cut to measurement. Ve'katsuv, and it is, help me with my English, bounded. What does the English say there? Measured, definite measurements. Uvahashlama, with perfection. Bli chisaron, without any lack. I'll stop there. In other words, the word pesel, meaning a carved object, by definition, what does it mean that something is carved? It means it's defined, it has boundaries, it's clear, it's absolute, and it's complete in and of itself. That's the definition of idolatry. Anything that's clear, absolute, well-defined, bounded without any possibility of change, that's idolatry. And what he's trying to say is that when your Torah, when your personal understanding becomes so absolute, as if it's carved in stone and could never change, you've taken your psolecha, your making of the tablets, and you've made it into pesel, into an idol.
And also no wonder they didn't want this book translated.
So you understand, yeah. Right? You understand the radical subversive nature of this book. That if you're trying to build a simple, strong, vibrant faith community, especially when you're trying to fend off the influences of secularism and relative thinking, you might say that this is a subversive text.
You should teach us a whole class of Meir
Shalom. I did a few years ago. I think Liz came to one or two classes, no?
Yeah.
So anyway, so you can't, you should never think you have the whole truth in your back pocket. That prevents any type of openness to spirituality, openness to development, openness to discovery. And the journey is dead. Spirituality comes to an end when the Torah becomes
understood.
A point of idolatrous worship, he claims. So,
does this apply to when you, like sometimes you perfect one thing specifically? So, I mean like, if you take, like as far as like the Torah, like if you're a learned person, you're perfect in the Torah, you understand everything, you make yourself perfect. Like you said with Moses, doesn't that mean give it the more reason for him to stay around and perfect the world around him?
No, because someone who's, let's say, reached perfection, theoretically, loses all connection to the world around him. He can't relate to us. There's nothing to learn from him.
Well, wouldn't the perfection give him even a better understanding of the world, though? Like, a way to relate to the world?
No, he wouldn't understand the flaw.
Because, let me give you an example.
Well, perfection... I think you're quite, enlightenment is a word that we think of, and I'm not sure enlightenment and perfection are the same thing. I don't know.
The word perfection is a... is a self-defeating word. Because we're saying perfection means the opposite of what we usually think perfection means.
Right.
Perfection for the Meshiloach is to be on a journey. That is, the journey towards perfection is perfection. And the greatest enemy of the journey towards perfection is perfection.
Right, because it can't be open. It stops the journey. Perfect.
So, remember that I said earlier that according to the Ramban's introduction to his commentary to the Torah, bringing the Kabbalistic tradition, God did not give us the absolute divine Torah, but only a shadow of it. Because the absolute divine Torah is the enemy of human perfection. Because had we had that, we would have been stifled. We would have been suffocated. We would have been turned into perfect angels who cannot search for perfection and therefore might not as well have been created. There's no point in it. And if Moshe Rabbeinu was to become perfect, then he's irrelevant. It's so other than us, it's either something we couldn't relate to at all or it would just suffocate us. It would drown us in a sense of inadequacy.
It helps us deal with the fact of the imperfection of all the major characters.
They're all on a journey.
And when you bring it down to just the psychological daily level of life, when you look at some of the psychological suffering, anorexia, and all of these psychological plagues of modern day, a lot of it comes from wanting to be perfect.
Right.
These people who think they need to be perfect, and then they suffer so because they can't be.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now, I'm just looking at the clock. I don't want to find us without time to go back to where we started and put it all together. So we're going to go back to where we started and put it all together. So we're going back to...
We're back to the journey.
Where we were in this week's Parsha. Parshat V'yetze, and we're reading again where we started, this time with a deeper understanding. And the opening words are V'hinei anuchi imach, behold I am with you, right? Back in the Me'a Shiloach. Does everyone see the place? Right after the vertical line that I put there, about the sixth? Okay. So everyone's here? Mm-hmm. Right where my finger is? V'hinei anuchi imach, v'lo ne'mar ani. It says, behold, I am with you, and the word is Anochi. And it doesn't say Ani, because the letter Chaf is indicative of the unlimited source of life. In other words, imperfection. The lack of complete divine revelation, that is the source of all of the meaning of human life without limit. It allows us the unlimited journey. As it says in the book of Yetzirah, Sefer Yetzirah, which is an old Kabbalistic work, V'hirah lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu az habiroim shitzterech od litbarer v'lisbol, and the Holy One, blessed be, showed Yaakov the purifications and the suffering that he will yet have to go through. In other words, when God says, I am with you, he shows Yaakov a movie of all his future suffering. That suffering is an expression of God being with him. And again, the paradox. If God had been with him in the sense that we usually understand it, of protecting him from everything, that would be actually tripping him up. Wouldn't be allowing him to live the journey. So how does God be with him? How does God protect him? By opening him up to trials and tribulations. That's God's protecting hand. To put it differently, Rabbi Tzadok HaKohen, the student of Me'a Shiloach, said the following. that when God hides his face, when you feel yourself in darkness, well, how does God hide his face? By God preventing the light of his countenance by shining upon, from shining upon you by putting his hand between you and the face. So when you think you're in darkness, you're really under the shadow of God's hand.
Oh, that's nice.
So in other words, darkness is really God. Because you need darkness for the journey. Va'al zeh hivtiach lo ushmarticha b'chol asher tilek. And concerning this, God promised him, and I will shmarticha b'chol asher tilek, I will guard you in all your goings. In other words, how does God guard him? How is God with him? By allowing him to stumble.
So is, Joe, I think of Joe.
That's a radical case, certainly. Yeah. But this does indeed relate to the whole matter of the book of Job. Vashivoticha el adama hazot. The verse says, God says, I will return you to this land. Remember, he's now fleeing to Mesopotamia. God says, I'll return you to this land eventually. And says the Meshiloch, Vashivoticha hu leshon hashavat aveda. I will return you is the language of returning a lost object. The implication is that for God to return him, he has to first be lost. So in a certain paradoxical sense, it's good to be lost in life. Because only people who are lost can find themselves. If you're not lost, you can't find yourself. And it's much better to be lost and to find yourself than to never be lost. Because not being lost is like being perfect. Say it again?
What if you never find yourself?
Right. Just let me respond to Liz a minute. What Liz is pointing out is the dangers of the journey. It's more comfortable not to leave your house.
Follow the rules.
And just follow everything. Completely and absolutely. And it's more difficult to be lost because you might not find yourself. And if you find yourself, it's pretty disconcerting. But there's no shortcut to spirituality or meaning or revelation except to be lost and find yourself. And it goes so far as the following, that the Meir Shiloach toys with the idea that it might even be a good idea to purposely lose yourself. He never says it explicitly, because you can't say it explicitly, but it's a dangerous thing never to be lost. Now again, what does it mean to be lost? It doesn't mean, for the Meir Shiloach, it doesn't mean to leave the Jewish people. It doesn't mean to disobey God. It doesn't mean to break the boundaries of the normative system. But it's a state of mind. It's a state of mind. It's not a state of behavior. It's a state of mind. It's a deeply, deeply dangerous state of mind. But it's also a deeply pregnant with possibility.
And do you think that different people have a different depth of lostness?
Everyone has to have their own depth.
People's paths are different. So some people are completely lost, and some people are somewhat lost in order to rebuild. And don't you think?
Clearly, and there's some people whose loss
is
too much that they'll never find themselves.
Right.
Maybe we are lost all the amount that we can afford to be lost.
Yeah,
Adam.
I was wondering if he returned Jacob. I mean, Jacob doesn't seem to really functional. I mean, once he gets back to the land. He loses Joseph, and then he's set into turmoil until he finally, meets up with Joseph. It's almost like he doesn't really return, in a sense, until he goes to the land of Egypt.
Perhaps Jacob is not to be seen as an individual, but as a building block of the Jewish people, and the Jewish people had to go through that stage of being lost, but to eventually
wander.
Go on the journey. So let's just read the last few words and then we will end. He brings now a passage from the Talmud that he brings again and again and again in different places, and he gives it a larger interpretation than probably was meant in the Talmud. Ki ein adam omed al divrei Torah, elim kein nichshalvem. And the proper translation I wrote at the bottom of the page, because the way he put it in his translation is no good, that you could never understand words of Torah unless you first stumble over them. that if you read a book of Torah or a physics, of complicated physics or mathematics, and you understand it the first reading, you really didn't understand it. But if you stumbled over it and you felt like you're hitting your head against a brick wall and it took you days to finally comprehend, and then the light bulb goes off, that's a level of understanding that is unparalleled compared to the simple, straightforward getting it the first time. You have to stumble. And that's all of life. Life without stumbling is not life. Is not meaningful. V'hainu ki al yedei ha-michshol shaba la'adam yikansu ha-divrei Torah b'lev adam b'cheshek gadol yoter mimikodem. That is to say, that through the stumbling, the words of Torah will enter a person's heart with greater longing and
desire
than otherwise. And he means divrei Torah, words of Torah, as a metaphor for all of life. That you will love life and cherish life and appreciate life and have a depth of life only if you had to struggle over it. V'zeu hashivoticha haynu lashon tshuva. And that's why it says, I'll return you. It's a language of return, of tshuva, of process. So just let's make it clear that what he's saying at the end is that God is with Jacob. But he's with Jacob with the chaf. He's with Jacob, he's kind of with Jacob. Because the real being with Jacob is not being with Jacob. It's allowing Jacob the possibilities of living his own life and stumbling his own stumbling in order that he eventually come to a deeper and higher and more nuanced understanding of what it means to be a human being and a Jew.
It's beautiful.
Wow. Mm.
Rabbi, is there a prayer in the morning service asking God not to test us too much?
Right.
Yes, that's the other point.
Right.
Well, to test us within what we're able to hold.
And it's a paradox. We prefer not to be tested at all.
Not too much.
No, but I'm saying the intuition is I want everything to be fine. I never want to suffer, right? I never want to have discord. I want to understand everything.
Growth, let me just have peace.
But it's an ephemeral desire.
This is the Greek thought nemesis, kind of the Greek notion that when you're too. I just read this Philip Roth book, Nemesis, so I studied up on nemesis, but when you're too complacent in your life, the nemesis, which is the Greek, comes to knock you off balance, because to be complacent is to be not alive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And hubris, when you think that you're too close to God,
exactly.
You're consumed and you're destroyed. You know, but I wanted to ask you something about what you were saying before. Isn't that exactly what the position of an anisim is? I'm probably mispronouncing the word. It means a forced one. A Jew who a Jew who has been compelled to give up Judaism back during the Inquisition or whatever, back before the expulsion from Spain. There are people who have been forced to stop being Jews, and in the process of rediscovering it, the descendants of Anisims are doing exactly what you are talking about.
True.
Those of us who, you know, have rediscovered Judaism are people who are on a journey. Based on what you're saying, Judaism should embrace people like that, not put them through a whole bunch of rigmarole about re-embracing Judaism.
But they need to be tested. They need to struggle.
That's a big test.
Well, okay.
Otherwise they don't grow.
But I understand the point very well.
The conflict
thank you.
Say it again, please.
Siddhartha is Buddha.